Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining. Welcome to the 8 Steps to Coalition Building, Fostering Strategic Partnerships to Prevent Violence Against Women conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer segment, and the instructions will be given at that time. I'd now like to turn the call over to David Lee. Please go ahead, sir.
Okay, and I apologize, everyone, for our technical problems, and we are working on it now. We have a new server that's been developed, and it appears that there are so many participants today, we have created some challenge with that. So we will continue as a conference call, and that all of you will have your slides available by going to www.preventconnect.org, click on today's session, the title of the session, which is on the home page, and you can, on your computer, get a copy of all the slides, either one slide per page in color, or we do have a handout of three slides per page. So we will be following along there, and we will be saying the slide numbers to you as we proceed. I apologize for this. If we are able to get connected, we will give you instructions in the middle of the conference. So welcome to today's web conference, 8 Steps to Coalition Building, Fostering Strategic Partnerships to Prevent Violence Against Women. I want to, on slide two, we have information about Prevention Connection and how you can reach us, and that myself, David Lee, and Chad Sniffen are your primary contacts, and you can feel free to contact us at our office at 888-922-5227. Right now, Chad is fielding many phone calls of people that have computer problems. On our website, you can get copies of our podcasts, online presentations, and our wiki. A wiki is a user-generated website to collect the ideas of our Prevention Connection users on how to do primary prevention of violence against women. You can sign up for web conferences and our web dialogues. We have begun reading clubs where we take articles and have small numbers of Prevention Connection participants discuss those articles and its applications to prevention of violence against women. We also have materials and archives, including recordings of our sessions, available on the website. What normally we would do is try to find out how many of you are new to Prevention Connection. This is the first time we haven't had our web conference work, and many of you I know are the first time there. So please, we bear with us, but we're really glad to be able to have you here for this web conference. And I will not be talking about how to use this technology since we can't be doing it. Prevention Connection talks about violence against women, which includes all forms of domestic violence and sexual violence. We look at violence across the lifespan. We seek to prevent violence before violence starts and to connect to other forms of violence. Prevention Connection works with several other nationally funded national resource centers, by the Centers for Disease Control, including the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, the National Youth Violence Prevention Resource Center, and VAWNet. Prevention Connection is sponsored by the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views and information provided in the listservs and web conferences do not necessarily represent the official views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCOSTA. I am pleased to be able to now turn over our presentation for today to Larry Cohen and Liz Waiters of Prevention Institute, who are valuable partners and leaders in talking about prevention of violence against women. So Larry and Liz.
Thanks, David. Hi, this is Liz Waiters from Prevention Institute. I'm the program director here. And welcome, everyone, to today's web forum, which is 8 Steps to Coalition Building, Fostering Strategic Partnerships to Prevent Violence Against Women. And I'm joined here by my mentor and executive director, Larry Cohen.
Hi there, everyone. I'm kind of excited to do this by phone. In the good old days of, 2 years ago or something like that, coalition building is actually a good thing to kind of really talk about. We not only have lost our internet connection, but we've lost a certain amount of time. So I think that doing this by telephone, we'll just kind of go through it a little bit more quickly. We'll skip a couple of things and make sure there's time for some good conversation and interaction, don't you think,
Liz? Yeah, I think that's a great idea. We've got a packed agenda, so we're going to try to keep up. And as David said, you know, one of our goals is always to experiment with technology. So we have a lot of room here for interaction with you all, but it may be a little difficult today. So when we come to a lot of questions, we just want you to think about them. But we're going to start off with a review of our agenda for today before we go right into it.
And that's on slide 11.
Yes, exactly. And what we're going to do today is give you an overview of what we're going to talk about, introduce the topic, and give a brief review of some of the things that we've done in our previous sessions. And then primarily we're going to focus on the 8 steps to effective coalition building, which is a tool for fostering and maintaining strategic collaboratives. And this is going to be followed by time for questions and discussion. And lastly, we're going to wrap up with an evaluation.
So on slide 12, you can see our learning objective. And the core for me, and I've been working in coalitions for a long time, and we'll come back to this, I'm sure, as we talk, Liz, is that a coalition is not an end in itself. So one of the key things we want to understand is the roles that coalitions can play in achieving outcomes for prevention.
Okay. And we also want you to keep in mind as we're going through this that our objectives for today are going to be, as Larry just said, understanding the role that coalitions can play, but also we want you to become familiar with the 8-step tool. And third, we want you to understand the relationship between objectives, coalition building, and structure in order to achieve your outcomes.
And so why don't we move then to, say, slide 17 and really talk about 8 steps. But I just want to kind of go back and mention a couple of things, Liz, that we kind of skipped over for the sake mm-hmm. of time, which is that when we're talking about coalitions as a tool, the focus today, though, coalitions can be used for lots of different purposes, and there are some, as we'll talk about, that they probably don't make sense for. But what we're really talking about today is using coalitions to encourage prevention changes. In other words, to encourage changes before problems arise. And we're also thinking a little bit about norms, I believe, right? And
exactly.
Where do you see norms as fitting in that?
As crucial to what we're changing. And just to kind of give you a brief review, we talked about norms last time and how important they are. We started off with asking you about envisioning a world without violence against women. And there are a lot of really powerful terms that you all came up with. And we also reminded you that, you know, achieving that vision is going to take a lot of work, but one of the ways to achieve that world without violence is through changing environments and changing norms. And one of the tools for changing norms we presented was the spectrum of prevention. And so today we're going to focus on one of those levels, which is the coalition building, fostering networks and coalitions. And most of you are going to be members of coalitions, so this isn't going to be anything new, but what we're going to go through today are the particular steps in building a strong and vital coalition.
So why don't we start that with kind of a worst-case scenario, which we have on slide 18, and it's really not important that you have it in front of you because, Liz, I was thinking that I'll be Dogbert, and why don't we read this Dilbert cartoon together?
Okay. All right. Let's see. So which one are you, Larry?
I'll be Dilbert.
Okay.
I'll be Dogbert. I'll be Dogbert.
Okay. All right. Well, Dogbert, I need you to facilitate some meetings.
What kinds of meetings?
Well, we are creating a process to fix our product development process. But first, we're having some pre-planning meetings to decide on a project name.
I think the name should be Death Spiral. You know, and I think the reason we wanted to share that, I think that a lot of us identify with Dogbert and with this comment because coalitions can feel like a death spiral. They can feel really, really pointless. It's kind of like, you know, as I said, the coalition's got to be an end. It's got to be have a purpose. It can't just be an end for itself. And sometimes, you know, coalitions can be incredibly hard work, mm-hmm. very frustrating, Liz. They can be really inefficient tools if they're poorly utilized. And, you know, frankly, you know, coalitions many times are viewed as a time drain. As, you know, as Dogbert and Dilbert might agree, yet another meeting that somehow has to be squeezed. And we all have incredibly busy days.
Mm-hmm. But for those of you who are following our slides, Slide 20 points out that if your coalition is working effectively and efficiently, then the coalition really can become your roadmap to achievement. What we want you to do right now is just think about some of the benefits of coalition work that you've experienced or that you know about. And for us, Larry, why don't you tell us what some of the benefits are?
Well, I think that really what coalitions can help us to achieve are things we can't do as well alone. If I can do it by myself and I don't need other supporters, you know, it's probably not going to be as effective. But if I want to spread the word massively to lots of different environments, if I want to change something fundamental, you mentioned norms earlier, Liz, and if we need to change a norm in the community, no one of us can change a norm. We really need to start to create momentum, universal agreement, or at least universal understanding. When we start thinking about multifaceted, big picture, that's why another term I like to use, and really although this is entitled Effective Coalition, we're really talking about a variety of different types of collaboration, a variety of different collaboratives. The focus, I think, is on achieving a broader range of goals than we could possibly achieve alone, broader buy-in, you know, to outcomes, you know, because we can capitalize on the diversity of skills and talents of different coalition members and also the different points of view that people bring to the table. You know, so the gist, I would say, is, you know, the ability to focus on comprehensive approaches.
Okay. And I would just add to that that an effective coalition can also help conserve resources. You can reach more people and accomplish broader objectives than any one group working in isolation. And you can also enhance one group's credibility and a couple of other things that coalitions can achieve as opposed to single individuals or single groups is that coalitions can provide a forum for sharing information and perspectives, especially if you have a very diverse membership. And also fostering cooperation. One of the things that we're going to talk about in a subsequent web forum is going to be issues of turf. And when you bring people together in a coalition, one of the things that you can sometimes smooth over are turf issues.
Mm-hmm. And so we were going to test your knowledge of coalition building with slide 22, and this is one place where it's kind of frustrating to not have the internet technology because I love this question, how many coalition members does it take to change a light bulb? And you get to cheat now because you don't need to give us answers, but just think for a minute. The questions we're going to ask you are, does it take all the members, a subcommittee, 5 members, 2 members, or none of the above? And, all right, I'll give you the answer. It takes none of the above, because this is an example of where you can kind of create that death spiral, because it doesn't take a coalition to change a light bulb. It takes a person to change a light bulb. You know, we don't need that tool to change your light bulbs, but sometimes, frankly, Liz, you know, people do that. Oh, we got to do everything together. We're a coalition. We got to make every decision together. And that's where it kind of becomes a little bit deadly and a little bit, for me, frustrating. You know, what's the point? Why are we getting together? What are the big picture issues? Like slide 23 says, you know, just as a carpenter joins wood to wood, a coalition brings people together, you know, to work together to influence outcomes. It's related to a specific problem. So a coalition leader is joining people to people.
Mm-hmm. And in order to be successful, coalitions are going to have to be strategic and as deliberate as possible. And this often begins with assessment. So one of the things that we're doing here, I mean, when we get back online, if we do, you'll see a series of questions. But one of the first questions that we ask when we're putting together a coalition is what goes into it. So, I mean, we all know that leading a coalition is hard work and that success is going to demand a strong leadership. Well, we're going to go through some of the questions here that you have to ask yourselves as you're putting together a coalition. The first one would be, are you able to inspire and motivate members of a collaborative?
Secondly, when you shape a coalition, how systematically do you think about how to make it effective?
Mm-hmm. And in every coalition in which we participate, We have to recognize that even as a participant, we have significant responsibilities for leadership.
Yeah, that's a really good one, and I wonder how many of you recognize that, mm-hmm. because, you know, sometimes we talk about coalition leadership, and the answer is, wait a minute, I'm not the leader. But I think if we're there, you know, we all kind of are the leader. And then another key question is, as a coalition and as a member of a coalition, can you influence key decision makers? Can you influence government agencies? Can you influence other organizations? And that's a very important kind of temperature check, thermostat on your coalition. If you feel like, yeah, we really have influence, people listen to us, you're probably getting a lot of traction. If you don't, I'd say there might be some adjustment. So maybe we should move to slide 26 then, mm-hmm. which is a picture of the 8 steps, and start talking about the steps in the coalition mm-hmm.
Larry, will you
together.
Give a little bit of a background on the 8 steps?
Well, the 8 steps was developed as a tool. It was originally developed, I'd say, about maybe 15 years ago for injury prevention coalitions. And we were working then on one of the first federally funded groups that was working both on traffic safety and violence prevention. And we started to realize that working together we could make a lot more sense. People all over the country were calling us and saying, how do you do that? And I found myself kind of tongue-tied, so I, with some colleagues, took a few months and really reflected. We call it 8 steps. Frankly, the first time we called it 12 steps, we said, you know, that's too complicated. So then we had 4 steps, and we said, no, that's too simple. So we said, you could break it into 8 steps. So obviously there's a little bit of an arbitrariness to it. But what we have found over the years is people feel like this is a really, really helpful checklist. It's a helpful way of kind of looking, and it's a way, you know, it's very useful in starting a coalition, but people also say it's very useful when you already have a coalition. And just to be clear, although I'm using the word coalition, I think that there's lots of terms, collaboration, mm-hmm. partnership,
mm-hmm. Alliance.
Alliance is a good one.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
But for the purposes of this presentation today and the tips that we're going to suggest, we want you all to think of all of these terms interchangeably.
So the first step then, which is portrayed on slide 27, is to analyze coalition building, you know, and to determine whether or not to form a coalition. And even if you're already part of the coalition, I think it's important to really, really look at the objectives and to say what approaches might be effective, and also to ask, you know, what are the community strengths, assuming it's a community coalition, and what are the community needs?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there a history of success or failure in dealing with similar problems? Are there groups that have similar objectives or work with related issues? You don't want to create a new group just because your purpose is a tiny little bit differently.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. And as Larry mentioned earlier, the spectrum of prevention can also be used to help clarify and plan the objectives of the coalition. So while individual skill building and prevention education, which are the first two levels of the spectrum, are important, most people are going to acknowledge that these alone are not going to be enough. So then in that case, the spectrum can help people design a strategy that will help them address broader environmental issues as well, which is going to be important when we're talking about large-scale change, like norms change.
And that's right, and I think that therefore the spectrum can be a really, really good planning tool, as you start to say, and we'll come back to it in step 3 again,
mm-hmm.
you know, what are some of the goals, what are some of the things we're trying to achieve, and particularly, as you're saying, Liz, it's not so much the educational work. The educational work can be done effectively. There are times a coalition can add value, but really it's the big change, the norms change, the change in policy, the change in the practices of your own organizations, but hopefully of multiple organizations. That's where you can really get, and we've seen a lot of traction mm-hmm. in coalitions. And I think, for example, the work you did in Oklahoma is really a pretty good example of that, right?
Mm-hmm. That was exactly the case in Oklahoma, where we helped to develop a rape and sexual violence prevention strategic plan with a collaborative that included the Oklahoma Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the State Department of Health, and the Attorney General's Office. To initiate the strategic planning process, this group was able to convene a diverse set of state leaders. And while the group explicitly acknowledged the value of prevention education, especially among parents, they concluded that parents alone couldn't protect their children from all the factors in the social, physical, and cultural environment that contribute to violence. So instead, the group decided to focus its objectives around several key environments that impact, in this case, sexual violence prevention.
That's right, it's the environment. And one of the key environments identified was the college and university setting. You know, they wanted to influence both physical and educational environment to improve both responses to and equally prevention of sexual violence. What's an example, Liz, of an organizational practice, you know, that a college or university could institute to achieve this objective that would make sense for a coalition?
Mm-hmm. Well, one that comes to mind is the Mentors in Violence Prevention, or MPV, program, which encourages athletes and others to confront abusive peers. And this was a model that was used to train players on both the Boston Red Sox baseball team and the New England Patriots football team to stand up rather than stand by. And this model it can also be used to empower student athletes to proactively confront abusive peers by using their leadership status to their advantage.
And I mean, one of the things when we talk a little later about membership, because this is really a highlight I want to mention now,
mm-hmm.
you know, having a group like the Boston Red Sox or New England Patriots, particularly this year when both of those teams have been so successful,
mm-hmm.
you know, can add a little charisma to the coalition. It can help get attention. You know, I like to go to meetings where there are people I want to rub shoulders with. So there's a lot of added value, and they not only play a key role in the coalition, but they also strengthen what might come from other members, because other members will be kind of attracted by that.
Mm-hmm.
I know the Oklahoma group also examined how they could influence policy and legislation to impact the key environments. You know, they used such precedents as Cambridge, Massachusetts, which had a citywide commitment to preventing domestic violence, where they created and passed a policy for a violence prevention zone.
Mm-hmm. And that was a very successful effort that definitely took a collaborative working together. And as Larry alluded earlier, groups can have interventions at any of the six levels of the spectrum. However, coalitions whose objectives aim to accomplish a combination of the spectrum strategies are generally going to be the most effective. So by grouping these separate approaches together, a prevention strategy is going to build on the strengths of each level and promote sustainable change. There really is a constant interplay between the activities along the spectrum as well as between the spectrum and individuals or group, which we like to represent in the jigsaw puzzle graphic that we showed last time.
Yeah, I think a jigsaw puzzle is a very, very good analogy because each piece can be really, really potent. But you put them together, you know, in a jigsaw puzzle, it really starts to make a lot more sense.
Mm-hmm.
You can create a whole different notion of a picture, or in our case, a picture of prevention norms change
mm-hmm.
than any one group might do alone. Also, for example, I know in Oklahoma, they were doing some work with public service announcements, you know, trying to promote healthy relationships, and that's portrayed on slide 32. But they realized that, you know, this kind of thing would really be enhanced if policies and organizational practice that limit the use of violent or degrading images of women in the media or in the workplace,
mm-hmm.
you know, if those were promoted, and therefore they could align their objectives accordingly.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the reasons that the Oklahoma group was so effective was in part because they exemplified step two, which is about recruiting the right people. And we just talked about some of the leadership issues and about
mm-hmm.
having, you know, name members in there, or I shouldn't say brand name members as part of the coalition. But although it might seem obvious, I think it bears repeating that having the right people in your coalition can often make or break the coalition's effectiveness and
mm-hmm.
ultimately is going to have a great impact on program effectiveness and sustainability.
You know, there was a New York Times article about business meetings in the
mm-hmm.
business section, and I kind of read it because I think obviously we can learn a lot from business, so sometimes our objectives are a bit more complicated and
mm-hmm.
and better.
No judgment,
right. But what it said is the most important element in the success of a business meeting, and I would think, oh, it's the agenda or it's the vision. But they said, no, the most important element is having the right people there in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And that really speaks to how important membership is. And a lot of times, as we'll see a little later on, you know, people just kind of bring together who's around,
mm-hmm.
and that's not a way. Membership should be very, very strategic. And that's why this step two is important in starting a coalition, but also it's important for those of you who are parts of coalitions to say, wait a minute, who's there? If I was going to think about it, who would I say I wish should be there and I really want to be there? Are there steps right now we should take to modifying this?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lot of what step two is about. You know, who's working on the same issue as you?
Mm-hmm.
You know, think broadly. Don't just think of the usual players, the standard partners.
Mm-hmm. You want to also think about who has influence on this issue that you're working on. And it's going to be very helpful to have influential partners or their representatives on board as early as possible.
Yeah, and then who's going to be supportive and who, you know, at times are going to put obstacles in your path.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to know who the opposition is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes it makes sense to invite the opposition, but one of my favorite questions when I do these trainings in person is to ask people, how many of you would invite your opponents? And almost everybody says yes. Almost everybody, and I think you've seen this in some of the trainings we've done together, raises their hand and says, well, we need to know what our opponents are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
We need to convince them. We're going to be blindsided if we don't consider them. They're going to
mm-hmm.
feel not included. And there are cases where that's the case. But a lot of people think of a coalition almost as a debate society. That's a big mistake. You've got to keep in mind the metaphor, get something done. None of you want to go again and again to meetings unless you've got a very boring job and don't have a lot of work left for you. None of you want to go to meetings where again and again the same questions are debated and there's not a sense of traction, there's not a sense of progress. When you have people who are opponents, unless you really feel there's a workability. For example, I worked, as you know, Liz, on the first local no smoking laws,
mm-hmm.
you know, multi-city no smoking laws, and the Tobacco Education Coalition came very, very early on. One thing they tried to do was to bribe me. They offered me quite a nice raise, in fact, and, you know, I'd be a lot wealthier now if I worked for them, of course. But the other thing is they said, hey, when you're doing your strategy, we want to be at the table with you. After all, you're kind of a public entity. Our strategy was what they were directly opposing. And, you know, to the extent that was possible, we did not want to be sharing tables with them
mm-hmm.
because, you know, their only goal, they were not going to be convinced, their only goal was to throw a wrench in our work.
Mm-hmm.
And so you need to be really cautious about this. We're doing a lot of work now on nutrition and activity. And again, the question's coming up, shouldn't the food industry be there? Well, sometimes yes. But there are times when they're really there to disrupt. And I think in the issues we're talking about today of violence against women, there are some people, for example, some of the advertisers, some of the alcohol companies that are really portraying women in a very abusive way. And we want to change those norms and practices.
Mm-hmm.
And the way to change those norms and practices isn't necessarily to sit down with them in the coalition.
Mm-hmm.
It may be to negotiate with them, but not at the coalition
mm-hmm.
table.
And that's not, you don't want to waste your coalition time convincing people about your position. And so in this sense, in dealing with the opposition, one of the suggestions would be to choose to invite a partner who knows how to work with or manage the opposition.
That makes a lot of sense, but I think it's going to come up in coalition discussion. So I think it's really something where there'll have to be some question about objectives. There'll have to be some discussion. You know, later on we'll talk about decision making.
Mm-hmm.
You'll need to figure out how to work that out with the coalition.
Mm-hmm.
It comes up again and again.
And one of the last things that you need to ask yourself is how many people should be involved in the coalition. You don't want your coalition to be so large that it's unmanageable, but also you don't want it to be so small that not enough can be accomplished.
That's a good point. And, you know, people who've studied group theory, I have a social work
uh-huh.
Background, and probably the ideal working group is probably 8 to 14. So for me, my ideal working group is a group of people I can sit around the table with and have coffee, maybe 2 or 3 people. You know, the point that makes, you know, it doesn't mean every coalition is going to be between 8 and 14 people
mm-hmm.
big. Some of them may end up being, and some of those of you who are out there, and we'll talk about this in the Q&A period, maybe coalitions of 40 people, maybe coalitions of 50 people. But if you know that 18 to 14 to 18, say, is the right size, or 8 to 14 is the right size, something like that. That tells you, if you've got 40 people there, you got to redesign the work. You got to do a lot of work in subcommittee. You can't expect to have the same level of conversation. Think of yourself, Liz. When you and I are sitting out having lunch, we both do a lot of the talking. Mm-hmm. If we're in a room of 12 or 15 people, like our staff meeting later today, we monitor ourselves. We might make one comment or two comments. So the dynamics of the group very much depend on the group size.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain kinds of conversations that are suitable for this right-sized coalition of, say, more or less a dozen people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's other structures that need to be put in place, particularly subgroups and working groups, as the coalitions get bigger.
Okay. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more when we talk about how often coalitions should meet and
what mm-hmm.
happens between times,
mm-hmm.
which really is contingent upon how many members you're going to have in your coalition.
Very, very, very much so.
Now, one of the really important things to consider about coalitions when we're talking about membership is who is going to be needed at the table to accomplish the group's goals. So when you're thinking about coalitions to prevent violence against women, it's important to understand why people join. One of the things that you want to think about is how you actively recruit members based on the goals or needs of the collaborative. One of the things that we like to talk about is that it's really valuable, or we like to describe how valuable it is for people to join. And we think about some of the reasons why people join, and think about the reasons that you're part of the coalitions that you're a member of now. If you're thinking about putting together a coalition, you want to think about why people would join, make that an attractive venture for them.
Mm-hmm. And I think that, it's a really interesting mix. You know, there are some people who join the coalition and they're very, very invested kind of in the coalition's goals, you know, because they just believe in the core goals of the coalition.
Mm-hmm.
There are other times it relates to their work. And, you know, they might not even put it that directly, but it's kind of like, well, you know, given my organization and given you're doing this work in the coalition, I pretty much got to be there. I want to influence the direction. I want to protect myself. Protection is an important
mm-hmm.
reason people join coalitions, because I don't want something else going on which is going off in a tangential direction. And also, of course, there's times where there's turf issues
mm-hmm.
associated, you know, with that as well, where it's like, well, you know, if the coalition gets the credit, what's going to happen to me? What's going to happen to my group? Another thing, though, that's really neglected is part of the reason people join coalitions, and particularly part of the reason people stick with coalitions, which is an important cue for all of us who play a facilitative or supportive role, is for personal reasons.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that you abandon this notion of what are we trying to accomplish here. But there are ways to focus on what you're trying to accomplish that are fun, that are entertaining, that are gratifying, that remind one another of the commitments that you're making, of the outcomes that you're achieving. Good refreshments go a long way for me in certain meetings that I look forward to, or others where I say, you know, I'm starving. Maybe I should go get lunch first. I'll get there a half hour later.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of different elements. And I think facilitators, and again, I want to go back to, if we're coalition participants, if we're invested in the coalition, we're all co-leaders, we're all co-facilitators, there are a lot of reasons that it's appealing for a lot of people. You know, and it's really that mix of reasons that a
mm-hmm.
facilitator needs to pay attention
and
to.
And I would also add to this, having been a university instructor, some people join because their bosses make them join. And it's in particular those people who have to join. All the reasons that Larry just mentioned, the personal gratification reasons, are going to be really important to play up for members who have been tapped to be there because they have to be there. It's going to be really important to draw those members in terms of the contribution that they can make, why it's important to their organization, and also why it's important to them, why it's important to the coalition to have these particular people be a part of
yeah.
it as well.
Yeah. Why don't I move us then to slide 38 and step three. You know, what step three is about is establishing a common purpose and, more specifically, setting preliminary objectives and activities for the coalition. In step one, you know, you need to start a coalition very clear about what you're trying to accomplish. But what step three is about is, after bringing people together, you know, melding those objectives with the objectives of other members. So you start to have a shared vision. And the spectrum is a really, really helpful tool for that, I think, Liz.
Yeah, I would agree. Three is about acknowledging and using the fact that each coalition member wears at least two hats. They're going to wear the hat of their own individual agency or organization and the hat of the coalition as a whole. So it's going to be important to create options that mutually satisfy the lead organization's objectives as well as the goals of other coalition members and groups, and to propose mutually productive activities and to structure both objectives and activities in such a way that all the coalition members feel included in the collaborative process.
That's right, and that feel included is an important term, I think, because there's almost another hat, which is the personal hat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we might have two staff people from our organization who would go to the same coalition meeting and would have different experiences, would have different feelings, would have different interests, and paying attention to, you know, who is the person, what do they like to do, where do they get a sense of accomplishment, is another really, really important part of that. And as, you know, based on that, I think you'll see where people make suggestions along the spectrum, you know, for the coalition to have its most impact. Another thing I think important about what you just said about the two hats, Liz, mm-hmm. is, you know, a lot of people have basically said, leave the hat of your organization at the door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't come in. When you come in, you're a coalition member. Well, for me, I'm very, very proud of the work of Prevention Institute, and if people said, come join the coalition, but don't pay any attention to your work, I'd have to say, wait a minute, I'm not sure it makes any sense, and I'm not sure that my funding and my job even permits me to participate in this. I think skillful coalition building, and as you mentioned, we deal with this a lot in some of our work on TERF, skillful coalition building means melding the objectives, which is why I really like your two-hat
mm-hmm.
analogy.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we want you to keep in mind is that there are going to be many types of collaboration.
Like Slide 40 shows.
Uh-huh. And typically people think of grassroots when they think of collaboration, and of course the Violence Against Women movement has its roots in the grassroots arena. However, working with other groups such as government and community-based organizations can increase the efficacy of a collaborative. More partners can mean bringing in a different kind of expertise, access to a wider breadth of resources, and more partners can also help you achieve your goals. Government, for example, often has resources for community efforts and can be a key partner not only in funding but also in providing other resources such as technical assistance and tools.
Yeah, I've found in many cases, it varies of course, but in many cases it's the intergovernmental coalition that seems to be the rarest.
Mm-hmm.
It's parts of government working effectively together. You know, when people pay their taxes, they kind of think there's a government, there's one approach, that it's incumbent on different organizations to work together. And that is the job of the chief administrator, whether it be the mayor and the governor, the president or whatever, to see that these different sectors work together. Well, intergovernmental collaboration is really an important tool, you know, to kind of think of, because we've got multiple systems on an issue like violence against women. It's going to cross health and human services, justice, enforcement, education, just, you know, to name a couple of those. All of these sectors can be, must be brought to bear in prevention. You know, law enforcement, for example, you know, has played an important role, despite mostly doing after-the-fact work, they've played an important role in promoting statewide after-school programming here in California, you know, as part of their crime reduction strategy. And when they said, wait a minute, we can't do it alone, that really helped to build the notion that violence against women is a community problem and that we all need to pay attention, that businesses, that community, et cetera, really need to play a role. We're talking really about a diversity of sectors mm-hmm. and systems.
Mm-hmm. And as Larry mentioned earlier, there's going to be often turf issues involved, especially when money and funding is at stake here. And Larry also mentioned, you know, the adage about leaving your organization or your organizational biases at the door. But we at Prevention Institute want to make TERF work for the coalition. So some groups are even pooling their limited RPE funds in a collaborative process to achieve greater outcomes. Now, we're going to be dedicating a full future forum to issues of TERF, so be sure to look out for that in the coming months.
But my favorite expression is that TERF is not a four-letter word,
mm-hmm.
but kind of related with TERF, and there's another tool that might be worth mentioning, kind of related to TERF is this notion of interdisciplinary collaboration. And so we created a tool with the name Collaboration Math. It's not math, so don't get intimidated. We just use that as a metaphor because really things add up and multiply and start to really kind of support one another. But you can see this on slide 42. You know, the tool, and you can see it also on our website and really get a much more in-depth discussion of it, and we'll come back to it in a future forum as well. But the tool is designed to eliminate the misconceptions that groups have about one another by just making goals, objectives, abilities, needs very, very explicit.
Mm-hmm.
It clarifies the benefit of collaborative participation. You know, it also helps understand what needs to be better understood, and it can really be useful also in identifying, wait a minute, there were some key players who have been missing.
Mm-hmm. It really is important in helping you figure out who needs to be invited to the table. And as Larry mentioned, we're going to be doing a future web forum on collaboration math, how to use that particular tool, and some of the different advantages of that particular tool. And that one's going to take place in March, March 11th, but basically, you know, keep checking the CalCASA website for that one as well.
Yeah.
If you're following the slides, we're on slide 43 now. And one of the things that we need to think about when we're pulling coalitions together is establishing commonalities among diverse groups. In that case, it's going to be important to realize that as critical as it is to keep a focus on the primary objective to prevent violence against women, it's not always necessary that this be the central focus of all partnerships. For example, a domestic violence and sexual assault partnership could join forces with a broader partnership focused on reducing racism, sexism, and homophobia. In fact, achieving mutual goals can often bring more power to the movement.
Yeah, that's a really important point, Liz. I think that, you know about the Take the Back the Music campaign?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were just talking about that yesterday, and one of the things that is going on in the rap industry, launched by Essence Magazine, while this is not explicitly a violence prevention-oriented group, the goal of this particular collaborative is to reduce the negative images of women in popular media by engaging hip-hop artists in dialogue and education about sexism and misogyny in music lyrics and videos. And I've seen some of those interviews where they bring in not only male hip-hop artists, but female artists and fans. And people actually get to come together and talk about, you know, this is what this image is about, this is how it reflects on women, and this is the impact that it has. And those messages get back to the industry, and changes are starting to happen.
That's really a kind of amazing, you know, it's really norms-changing work. I mean, I really find that this forming broader partnerships is kind of, you know, at times it's more challenging than just saying, wait a minute, we know exactly what we're trying to accomplish. But it's much more creative, and at times the, you know, the impact, as you're describing, the impact can be very, very great. And, you know, there's no question that if we're going to be talking about racism or sexism or misogyny or homophobia, and, you know, that if we can have an impact on that and get all the players there, clearly that's going to have a significant impact on violence
mm-hmm.
against women.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's also, you know, value when we just join forces with other advocates and other practitioners, particularly when they're working on other forms of violence. Because I think we all feel a bit isolated, and I think that, you know, we know there's an interrelationship between different forms, and sometimes by working together we can do more to break the cycle, because we know there's a cycle in families, there's a cycle in communities, and we have a lot to learn from one another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And as we move on to step four, once you've determined the right people and set the preliminary objectives, it's time to convene your coalition.
Yeah, and this is when we like to ask the question, how do you convene the coalition? Do you do it through a meeting? Do you do it through a workshop? Do you do it through a conference? Is it all of those? Is it some other way? And most people say all of the above. And again, this is a place where my experience, Liz, has been that you try and convene your coalition at a meeting. A lot of people I've seen, I remember one coalition recently at a statewide BV conference, and people came in and said, well, we're going to form a coalition at the end of the conference. So they had some guest speakers, and then they had some working sessions and some planning sessions, and about 3:15, and you can kind of picture that people who had to travel a bit further were probably heading home. Many of the parents who were worried about daycare maybe heading home a little earlier. Some of the people who hadn't been as fully engaged but might bring a lot to the table, say law enforcement who'd made a showing, were heading home, because the coalition was not convened intentionally, going back to step two and saying, who do we know most need to be there?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of as well whoever happens to be around. If it's not important to convene intentionally, in most cases, you know, it's not important enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think the notion convened through a meeting, this is maybe one of the simplest steps because that's all you got to do. You know, and but you got to do it that way, I think.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I can think of a couple of exceptions, but really not many.
Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. Now, let's move on to step five. Effective coalitions are generally going to require a minimal financial outlay for materials and supplies, but they will require a substantial time commitment from people. That said, step five of effective coalition building is anticipating the necessary resources. So what you have to do in this step is estimate how much of the footwork will be the responsibility of the lead agency and how much is going to realistically be expected of members. You need to anticipate that members are not always going to fulfill their commitment. And you also have to be appreciative of what is done rather than being moralistic about when people can't accomplish everything that they planned. Now, one thing that you can expect is extensive staff time that's going to be demanded in all the areas that, if you were following us on the slides or on slide 49, specifically clerical tasks such as mailing, typing minutes and agendas, photocopying, and making reminder and membership phone calls. Meetings are also going to take time and resources in the form of planning agendas, taking minutes, locating and preparing the meeting site, planning facilitation, coordinating with the coalition's chairperson or the steering committee, and providing refreshments, as Larry mentioned earlier. Now, the extent of all this work is going to vary, obviously, depending on the objectives of the coalition.
But I think it's important, you know, just as you're pointing out, that it usually is a lot. And I think it gets underestimated. I say to people, you know, figure out what you think it's going to take and double it. And this is particularly important and as coalitions are coming to an end, because many of these resources really, really are critical.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, if you don't have someone who's really paying attention to making sure the meeting notices go out and all of a sudden there's a meeting, happens last minute and it gets really frustrating because people get lost or, you know, they show up the wrong day or some people don't know about it, so the turnout is small, it just doesn't work. And one of the things I found is, you know, some coalitions I've been part of where maybe there's funding and people say, gee, this is really great, the funding's ending, we're going to continue. You know, unless they're really clear and make serious commitments about those resources, it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there's a little bit of magical thinking that goes on, oh, it's no big deal. And it's not a super big deal, it's just resources.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it really is a big deal.
I think so. I would totally agree. We just want to wrap up this step, and as we wrap up step five, we want to emphasize that although coalition members may wear two hats, a coalition leader has to wear many hats in terms of the time, commitment, and roles they're going to necessarily play. So as we move on to step six, this step is about developing an effective coalition structure, which really gets to the anatomy of the coalition. And that includes answering questions like, should a coalition be ad hoc or ongoing?
Let's talk about that a minute,
because
okay. That one comes up a lot, you
uh-huh.
know. And most people, I think, say coalition should be ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this violence against women stuff, it just ain't going to go away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we need to have a force. There's some reasons that make a lot of sense. One, because it's not going to go away. Another, because the coalition starts to develop some reputation. I like to think of a coalition when it's working almost as a magnet. It attracts people. It attracts attention. Media will know it exists, et cetera, et cetera. So there's some really good reasons for permanence. But from the perspective of getting tasks done, I think that people really underestimate the value of an ad hoc group. if there's a group, say, Liz, and we say, hey, we're going to meet for the next 9 months, and we want to work on changing these norms in these universities through these methods, and I say to you, it's 9 months, you take a look at your schedule. If you can really have a sense of the outcome, every month is precious. The notion of accomplishing something in a set amount of time really, really makes sense, and it's much more appealing. And I've been involved in some coalitions where, you know, there was one I was working in county government, and people assumed, you know, there were 20 different parts of county government. Everybody there was incredibly committed, but they also were very busy and looking at their calendars. And the first thing I said when we walked into the room, and I had my boss, who's the head of the health department, I had his support on this. The first thing I said is, we are asking for monthly commitments for, and everybody kind of waited, 6 months. 6 meetings. A little work between meetings. And you could hear the sigh of relief in the room. It felt doable. What we outlined as accomplishments felt very, very important and ambitious, but possible within the 6 month meeting. You know, it was almost 30 people at that room that virtually nobody missed one of those 6 month meetings. And my bet is if we said, oh, we're just going to continue to do that, that people would show up, not show up. But the time gave a sense of urgency and a sense of purpose. It kind of put a boundary around it. Mm-hmm. So I think in terms of, obviously, the answer to all these questions about coalition anatomy is it depends. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm kind of going into length here because I know people thinking aloud were probably saying ongoing in most cases on the phone. Mm-hmm. And we open it to Q&A. Please tell me if I was wrong about that. But that's why I really wanted to answer.
And I think that, I mean, the way you described it makes perfect sense, too, because there's that old adage that whatever task you have will expand to fill the time that you have. So if it's an ongoing coalition with no timeline, if you know, you're talking about accomplishing certain objectives, yeah, it's going to take that much time, which is forever. But if you put a cap on that, you have a much more likelihood of getting people motivated to continue.
Yeah, and I think that slide 56, which says it depends, is really key for all the anatomy questions. But I really want to emphasize, like, when we say it depends, it doesn't mean it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It means it matters very, very deeply. And that comes up on other coalition anatomy questions. I like to use the word the anatomy of the coalition, like, you know, how long the meetings should be, mm-hmm. how frequent they should be, mm-hmm. What the agenda should consist of. I think agendas need to be planned very, very carefully because, and they obviously interplay with the members. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to have a little time. Firstly, people want to know who's there. Mm-hmm. When I go to a meeting, I want to know who's there. So unless it's a huge group, you want to have a little time for some kind of introductions and updates. People want to know there's a place on the agenda to give a pitch for what they're doing or to share something that's exciting, but not too much of that or mm-hmm. that becomes the whole meeting because a lot of times we're interested in norms change, we're interested in policy, having some kind of a political update there. Mm-hmm. Again, to use that word I used before, you know, it adds a little charisma to the meeting. Mm-hmm. You know, those are some of the things to think about when we were talking earlier about subcommittees. I think every subcommittee needs to give a subcommittee report, even if they say, gee, we haven't met since the last meeting, to remind people that the subcommittees are related to the coalition as a whole and that the whole is the sum of the parts and to get people thinking about those things. Mm-hmm. Anything else strike you?
Well, let me ask you this, Larry. How long do you think meetings should last?
Well, it depends. I think, you know, I think most meetings work best when they're between an hour and a half and 2 hours. I think after 2 hours, meetings start to drag. But one of the things it depends on is how far away people are. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it also depends on the urgency of the situation. Mm-hmm. Typically, I think most coalitions should meet every month or every couple of months, often enough to maintain the continuity, but not so often that it feels like it's just too much work, and then people start picking the meetings by time. So let's say a group's meeting every month or every 2 months. I think probably I would tend to a two-hour meeting. An hour and a half in some ways is a little crisper, mm-hmm. but given that people come a little late, you want time for people to get to know one another, I think the 2 hours can work. There's a statewide coalition we're part of here now on a different topic, on nutrition and activity, and people are coming from different parts of the state. We tend to make that a three-hour meeting. Mm-hmm. We used to make it a five-hour meeting, and, you know, we'd serve lunch and stuff like that, and that kind of drags for people. So instead we make it a three-hour meeting, maybe three and a half, and then most people stay for lunch anyway and really have that time together, but it's not part of the meeting. It doesn't feel like the same sense mm-hmm. of commitment. But it's interesting that then people really stay. whereas if it felt like a five-hour meeting, I bet in some cases people would leave.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the things that you have to consider. If people are coming from far away,
Absolutely. They're
probably going to meet for a longer time but less frequently.
That's right.
Yeah, and then when you're meeting less frequently, you have more time in subcommittees to get a task accomplished.
Yeah, and I think the 8-step paper, you know, lays this out in more detail. But
mm-hmm.
what, you know, I'm hoping to do here on the phone, even without the benefit of the pictures for many of you, is, you know, that we're just kind of giving you these things to think about and really the notion that it's a systematic process. And so we can really go through, you know, steps 7 and 8 even a little quicker so we get to the Q&A.
Mm-hmm. So if those of you who are following on the slides, we're on slide 59 now, step 7. And one of the questions that you have to ask yourself is, how do you know when a coalition is floundering? Well, most people are going to say that people just stop showing up.
That's right.
Which is a very, very sure sign. So what do you do when that happens? Well, on slide 60, what you start doing is getting on the phone and calling people.
That's right. A lot of people say, well, you kind of pull the coalition together and say, wait a minute, what's working and what's not working? And actually, that misses the fact that a lot of people, as you said, have stopped coming.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to get on the phone and talk to those people as well. You really want to understand, and sometimes it's hard to understand or get to it. But, you know, some of the other things people are going to say is, oh, yeah, but every time I bring up an idea, somebody says, yes, but, or we're having the same conversations again and again, or we kind of continue to meet, but our initial goals have disappeared, we don't have a sense of the goals, or, you know, there's this one person I just can't relate to. That's a really tough one
mm-hmm.
when that happens. And sometimes it's that turf that gets in the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's why we wrote this whole paper on turf. It probably was the most common barrier or the most frequently identified issue of why people started to feel frustration with meetings and stopped showing up or
mm-hmm.
came late, et cetera, et cetera.
As we said earlier, we're going to have an entire session devoted to strategies for overcoming turf issues. And our last step, step 8, is about making improvements to your coalition through evaluation. And this is an important opportunity to get constructive feedback. Components of coalitions that should be evaluated include the objectives, activities, processes, and unanticipated events as well. And by assessing the processes and outcomes and impacts associated with coalition activities, staff are going to be better able to improve the outreach and coordination skills, and members can determine which strategies will help the coalition achieve its ultimate goals most effectively.
Yeah, I think that evaluating these processes also gives people a sense of assurance that people are paying attention, that their time is valued, that the efforts are valued. But that's if not only the coalition is evaluated, but there are steps taken to respond to those evaluations and to make changes.
Mm-hmm.
If we could, I think we should open up the phone lines now. As we do that, and we'll just kind of, people can just kind of toss in whatever questions they have or comments or experiences we have. As the phone lines are opened, I just kind of want to close, and I think it's we may have the slide from Sherry Brown. I'm not sure we do, but Sherry Brown said, slide what? Thanks, Nicole. Nicole is here helping me. Slide 65, coalition organizers should avoid getting so caught up in any one effort as to view it as make or break, because every effort prepares for greater and more sustained efforts in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And while I think that, you know, kind of this notion of having clear objectives is important, there are also a lot of unanticipated outcomes. And there may be a lot of things happening. And also, it's not what the coalition as a whole accomplishes. It's the dyad, it's the triad, it's the way that individual people do their work in a more effective way as a result of being exposed to the coalition goals. So there's a lot of benefits from the coalition building.
Mm-hmm.
And
I mean, even if things don't work out, those are learning opportunities
right.
to figure out how to fix them. So we want to leave you with this message, which is to remember that just about every carefully crafted coalition is going to have an impact, one way or the other. Efforts might fail, they might partially succeed, then falter, and so on. But since mutual trust is built up over a period of time, coalition organizers need to avoid getting so caught up in any one effort as to view it as make or break. Every single effort at cooperation among groups prepares the way for greater and more sustained efforts in the future. Coalitions consist of people, which is what we've been saying over and over again, and therefore shared efforts are going to leave us with surprises, memories, and mutual respect.
Yeah, and I think the term I'd like to underline, Luke, of yours is carefully crafted, that every carefully crafted coalition. I mean, this is kind of a funny kind of training because on the one hand, you know, as you said, it's about people, and each one is going to be different, but this notion of careful crafting, just to go back to that wood analogy, a good craftsperson, and I always think of craft as a mixture of science and art, a good craftsperson is going to do their work based on the ingredients and using their tools well.
Using the right tools, using the right, and the quality material, picking that material carefully.
So why don't we open it up then? I hope there's some comments, and thank you for sticking it out through this unanticipated and harder way of talking about this issue.
So the operator should be, can you please give instructions on how to do the questions and answers?
Absolutely, David. Everyone will now begin the question and answer session. If you have a question, please press star, then the one key on your touch-tone phone. If you are listening on a speakerphone, you will probably need to pick up your handset before pressing star one. If at any time you'd like to remove yourself from the lineup, please press star two. Our first question is from Rose Wild from the Oregon Department of Health.
Hi, Rose.
Hey. I think we may have met on a few of these before. So I have an interesting coalition, which isn't exactly working on violence against women, but more about at-risk girls.
Okay.
And it's really, we're all very interested in it because it's a bunch of movers and shakers and the business community as well as just philanthropists and agency leaders and things like that. So it's kind of got a lot of potential to do a lot.
Okay.
But they're coming from very different perspectives and understandings and backgrounds and education and so on. And I'm and it's somewhat, some of them are familiar to each other and some aren't. And lately I've been noticing some sort of undercurrents of power dynamics, which I think most people are sort of not fully aware of, or at least they're aware of how they feel, but not how other people feel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a group where I don't have a lot of status, particularly of being a state employee and kind of more there to provide information rather than leadership.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to figure out how to kind of encourage them to do some sort of, you know, like in class we call it conscientization, but essentially, you know, unveiling and discussing the power dynamics in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not quite sure how to approach that with them. I mean, they've been meeting for over a year now, so it's not, you know, a new group, but I don't think they ever really did that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that I'm going to start with is one of the advantages of the group that you've described is the diversity, because you do have a lot of different perspectives on the same issue, and that's a very important thing in any coalition. Larry, what would you suggest?
Well, I think that's an important point, and I'm not sure I would actually start by asking people to talk about the dynamics in the room, particularly if the dynamics aren't right. Because I think you need a certain amount of trust, and I think people may not really get to the root of things. It can be a frustrating experience. I might use a tool like our collaboration math tool to try and get people to lay out some of the values of their first experience, some of the perspectives that they bring, and see whether that would reveal, and either you or someone else facilitating it, Rose, you know, whether you could kind of get to kind of, well, gee, it sounds like you have these things in common, but maybe your perspectives on these issues are different. And the way the collaboration math tool is designed, you could pick certain categories which you think might help to reveal those conversations. It might be, you know, I think if and we didn't talk about this earlier, partly because of time, but I think if everyone online were to close your eyes and think of a coalition, and I'd say what's come to mind, I bet 80 of you would say a group of people sitting around a table. And I think one of the mistakes is to assume a coalition is always a group of people sitting around a table. Sometimes it's someone not around the table that can add a lot of power to a coalition, for example. They may never come to a meeting, but they're a supporter, their name's on the letterhead. You know, they have a surrogate employee. if that's the right term to attend, et cetera, et cetera. But another way to think about this kind of not around the table is that the members of the coalition are members whether they're all there at the same time or not. And I'm bringing that up because I would probably, and again, you know, what clout you have, you might want to do it with someone who's perceived as having more clout than maybe you could go to and say, hey, I'm kind of observing this and I'm afraid we're not going to get our goals met. But I would think about some one-on-one meetings. You know, where you could kind of feel people out, you could talk about what's working for them, what's not working for them, you know, what they're really out to get, whether there are any ways of helping them. Because as we all know from the mediation work that many of us have been involved in, or as many of us know from mediation work we've been involved in, it's often possible to construct win-win situations. Mm-hmm. And people at times assume that other people in the room are trying to do something which is opposed to them or which is using the same resources in a different way, mm-hmm. as opposed to that there are things we can achieve, you know, where the pieces are put together. Mm-hmm. So I kind of want to emphasize almost the detective work first. Try and get a little bit sense of what's better sense of what's going on. And also, if you don't feel the sense of power, some of your power can come just from saying, hey, wait a minute, I'm an advocate, I care about this a lot, it matters a lot. But in some cases, particularly as you say, if you're a government employee here, and some people may have their own feelings about that, it might be who can you pair with, who you can partner with.
Mm-hmm. And I think also what's really important is that you're all working towards the same issue. And I really like Larry's suggestion about the collaboration math tool, too, because that also points out the contributions of each representative. And no one contribution has to be any more important than any of the others.
Yeah, we have about 5 minutes left. That was a great question, Rose. Thanks so much for asking it.
Yeah, thanks, Rose.
Thank you.
I hope the answer was helpful, Rose.
Oh, yeah, that's the one on slide 42. That's collaboration math.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff on our website, preventioninstitute.org, but more importantly, I think it's our next training, or maybe the one after next, March 11th will be.
On March 11th, we will be doing a web conference on collaboration math, and also in May, we will be doing one on TERF.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Operator, do we have any other calls?
Yeah, we actually do have three questions. Our next question comes
to them all.
Sure. Our next question comes from Suzanne Quinn of Victim Response Inc.
Suzanne, are you on the line?
Hi, Suzanne. Okay, our next question comes from Velocia Umer of Houston Area Women's Health.
Hi, this is Velocia.
Hi.
And I was wondering, how do we get, how do we approach introducing sexual assault prevention to other members that we might want to join our coalition, and this might not be their issue particularly?
Larry?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is, you know, to go back to what we were saying with Rose, a lot of the introductions are best in one-on-one meetings. And, you know, it's really sitting down with people. And it's also keeping in mind that if you have an organization involved, but the member changes, that's another time that it's really important to do that. You know, when a coalition starts, we often take a lot of time explaining to people what's happening, but as it develops, we often say, oh, they get it. In fact, once a coalition develops, it's much more complicated, and if somebody becomes a new member in an existing coalition, they need even more orientation. But the other thing that I think, Liz, you pointed out before, is kind of the importance when working with people with broader or different perspectives in trying to make the links. Mm-hmm. So you might want to identify what are some of the issues that they care about, what are some of the ways that there's a commonality. Sexual assault might not be someone's issue, but perhaps workplace justice might be, and they could see some of the similarities there, or health might be, and you might want to arm yourself with some data on what a major health problem, you know, sexual assault is. It's kind of getting a sense of where's the person coming from, mm-hmm. and why are they relevant. And I would think if you were asking them to be part of the coalition, you probably had a pretty good idea that they got that. You know, sometimes with a celebrity, you don't know whether they got it or not, and then you really want to do a little bit more research. Say, gee, we really need a celebrity. How do we find someone who supports this issue? You want to find someone who really cares about it, and, you know, networking, of course, is always helpful.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going to refer you back to the collaboration math, so, because that's a really great way to help you focus on what other groups may have to offer, so that when you're approaching them, also, people want to be helpful, And sometimes it's easier to approach them with a way that they can help. And as Larry said, you probably have a very good idea already what they can contribute to your coalition. So bringing them in may just be pointing out to them very specifically ways that they can become engaged, ways that they can contribute to the broader effort as well.
Yeah. Another question, please.
Our final question comes from Anita Mendez of Polis.
Hi, I'm calling from New Hampshire.
Hi, Anita. Welcome.
Staying warm, Anita?
No. I mean, actually, today is a warm day, and it might be 17.
Oh.
but at least we don't have the wind chill today. So, but my question is that I am a woman of color interested in doing women of color leadership. Mm-hmm. And I work as a volunteer for the coalition. I'm not paid staff, but I've been working with the coalition in New Hampshire for about 30 years. So I've been around that long. But our people of color population is very, very small. And we've just had a boom with a lot of the immigrants. So that has pushed us up to 4% of the population.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually went around to in a conference, and I asked people, women of color, if they wanted to gather around this issue about violence against women and the issue of racism and how that affected our lives, and got a bunch of names. But when it came to actually sending out information and asking people to come to a meeting, only 5 returned any answers. So I'm wondering if you've got suggestions about how to encourage people to come along.
Okay, I'll let Larry do the anchor on this, but I'll start off by saying, repeating one of the things that we suggested earlier, is getting on the phone and calling those people who didn't show up and trying to figure out an informal assessment. Why? Was it the distance? Was it the time? Was it the place? Did they have other commitments? Figure out what was keeping them and figure out ways that you could kind of avert those particular obstacles. Larry?
Well, I totally agree with you, Liz. The only thing I would add to that is there might be some situations where maybe they're not going to share that with their caller.
Mm.
You know, and so thinking about maybe some of the other 5 who did show, who obviously are showing an investment to this, and saying, hey, wait a minute, this is a good cadre to start with. To doing some thinking amongst people of how do we spread the word, because I'm assuming those people didn't just want training, but they really wanted to see an impact. And, you know, sometimes we do better with a small group starting out, and the small group builds from there than wanting a big group when, you know, maybe people are coming, you know. It's hard to speculate, obviously, from a distance,
mm-hmm.
but hopefully that's a little bit helpful to you.
And one of the things that Larry said earlier, too, is basically if you build it, they will come. So sometimes people are waiting to see that this coalition gets off the ground before they start joining as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Why don't we, I'd just like to say this has been great, and I thank you all for sticking it out. And
yes.
Liz, I really enjoyed this conversation with you, and the element of surprise always adds a little surprise. And why don't we
hi, Larry.
Back to David.
Larry?
Well, great. Well, thank you, everyone, for participating in today's Prevention Connection web conference. You will receive an email shortly with the evaluation link, so please fill it out and feel free to complain about the technology appropriately. We will get this resolved for our next web conference. That will be on March 11th, and we will be sending out emails to you all about how to register for that web conference, talking about collaboration math. Please visit us at www.preventconnect.org. We'll have materials from this web conference, and you can get other information about the discussion of prevention of violence against women. So thank you all, and hope you have a good remainder of your day.
This bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks, David. Thanks, Larry. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.